Thank you all very much. It's the first time I've been in Skokie. I'm no longer at the University of Maryland, so you have an old a list over there, but just at Hopkins. And they say people are never jealous of their students or their children. And Reuben Brand over here, Rabbi Reuben Brand, is an old student of mine from long ago. And I'm thrilled that you guys in Chicago had the good sense to appoint him to a leadership position. And without any further ado, I'll get down to business. Because that's what we're here for. Talking about Ashkenaz and Sephardim and various other things like this. Let's go back to talk about Eretz Yisrael. And one of the points I want to start with is to say that in the Middle Ages, Israel was a backwater, was a nothing. That's interesting. And one of the definitions, not the only one, of the Jewish Middle Ages is when Israel was off the charts. You can't name me, I don't think, any famous Rishon or something like that from Israel. You got guys from Ashkenaz and Sephard, of course, from Germany and France and Spain and Italy and other places, certainly Babylonia, but nobody from Israel. True? The 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, it's interesting. And there are reasons for it, of course, but nevertheless, a key definition or characteristic of the Middle Ages when Israel was out of the way and not a significant Jewish center, although there were Jews living there. And that's actually part of the problem because particularly after the second half of the Middle Ages, you know, the Crusaders killed them out, but then they came back right away. And the Israeli Jews, as is the problem all the time, the big problem with Israel, the Israelis, as they say. So the Israelis have that terrible reputation for fighting, for telling, for getting people in trouble, handing them over to the authorities, for killing. It was rough. It's very famous that the famous Jewish poet Yehuda al-Kharizi, who's my favorite Spanish poet, visits Jerusalem early in the 1200s, not long after the city's been recaptured by the Muslim, by Saladin. And as he puts it, "Miyom shalachtu yishmeilim echzirili yisraelim," that when the Crusaders were there, at least officially the Jews were not allowed to live there, but from the time the Yishmeilim until the time the Arabs or the Muslims reconquered it, the Jews have re-entered it, and he goes to visit the sites, the culture, and all the rest of it, but then he immediately runs into the locals, the Israelis, and he says, each one is burning each other on the pyres of a discord, and fathers are murdering children, children murdering fathers, meaning everybody telling on each other, and the Jews had a very bad reputation over there. This is just a notorious fact of the 12, 13, and 1400s. And I have a little text, I don't want to spend a lot of time on text over here, it's not my style. But at the top of the page you have a short paragraph from perhaps the most famous or one of the most famous Ashkenazi rabbis of the 1400s, Trumas HaDeshen, if that means anything to anybody, Yisrael Isserlein from Wiener Neustadt near Vienna, a big rabbi, an ancestor of mine. And a guy writes to him then, he said, I'm thinking of Mikhail Aliyah. So there's a guy in Austria, a Jew, from Jew, Talmud Chacham, and for the best of reasons, because Jews want to move to Israel. In the old days, he said, should I move to Israel? He said, I can't recommend it. He said, Masha kosafta li aliyascha l'eretz tzvi. You're writing about your plans to make aliyah to Eretz Tzvi, to Israel. But l'ir ha-kodesh yibone b'mheir yameinu. Yimitzu hiata afilu talmid chacham ho'el v'em lana ba'onos kibbutz b'churim b'talmidit Torah l'sham. No yeshiva's there. Here in Ashkenaz, where you live, especially with Trumas HaDeshen in Austria, big area of yeshivas, Torah learning. Move to Jerusalem, it's Jews, no yeshivas, no kibbutz, Talmid Chacham, as they call it over there. Should you do it? And his answer is, Da'alecha, the Bavadi Shevach Gadol, Ma'ali Yeshel Adam, Adar Be'ez Yisrael. No question that I hold, like everyone else, that's a great zechus and so forth, religiously to live in Israel. The Kolshkin Bira Kodesh, Toel Zolom Habalom, as a it helps you as far as your olam haba is concerned, as well as your olam hazeh. Amnam. However, my friends, shamanu kama pamim sheish lisham bnei brit marvim. We heard there are a lot of these Western Arabic Jews, those Moroccans and people like that, Algerians, who moved there. Nechshavim l'rshayim gemurim. They're totally Russia. Rshayim gemurim. Mosrim mefursamim. They're terrible mosers. They'll tell you to get you killed by the Arabs to take your money. You know what Masira is, I assume. Behem tordim aval b'lim Ashkenazim sheim shomrei Torah. And they terrorize and bother all the Ashkenazim move there who come with shomrei Torah from God. So somebody like Trumas HaDeshen type, his rabbinical sword, moves to Israel. He doesn't know about the black market and things like that. Oh, they'll eat you alive. Begam ki mizonis dechukim mitzumsam sham laod rechim kashim. The economy is very tough. Very hard to make a profit. Mi yecholam obechol zeh. Who can handle that? Mavad godol rishas hashmilim sham. And I'm not even talking about the Arabs yet. Right? Lachein kol yishi shar basmo basagas kufum amona beizidarech yucholamo biyuris Hashem. So you have to decide for yourself. Because the key point is to do the Shmiras HaMitzvos and Yiras Hashem. If you think you can handle it in a new situation, go for it, but be warned. And this is the leading Ashkenazi rabbi and a very great saint in the 15th century. And it doesn't change, as I say before, in the 1200s, 1300s, and 1400s, except at the end. Two events happen. One is the arrival of a guy who's very smart and clever, diplomatic, how to get along with people. That's the Bartanura. I'm not referring to the wine, of course, but to the guy. The famous Avadya Bartanura, Italian rabbi, wrote the immortal commentary in the Mishnah. So you know he's a giant. Talmid Chacham. A very smart individual. He had, maybe some of you have seen, they translate now very often, the letters that he writes on his journey to Palestine, which was an unusual business, back in the 15th century, for some reason went on a roundabout route. You know, really it was like an 11-day journey from Venice to Palestine. It wasn't that long, but in Venetian triremes. But nevertheless, he went on a roundabout way. It must have been a war or something. And when he got there, he knew how to get along with these people. He said, I don't have any trouble with the locals. And he moved there not simply with the idea that he wants to live in Israel, but he wants to try to revitalize Judaism and make it a Jewish center once again. Wants to make a yeshiva. And then, to his luck, he came there 1490. 2 years later, the Jews are kicked out of Spain. You already start to get at least a small trickle of boys from Spain, who got to go somewhere, and some move to Israel. And that's the beginning of the modern Aliyah, if you want to get down to it. That's the beginning of the beginning. It's very small, okay? And it starts to get a little bit of numbers, and he turns Jerusalem into a place of Jewish culture, which it hadn't been before. It was just of Jews. And other Jews moved there, Sephardim, in the course of the early 1500s. We're most familiar with Sfas, that's why you go there, because that was the period when these Sephardic, primarily, Jews go there, the Kabbalists and the Halachists. And by the time you get to the 1500s, Israel, for the first time in a long time, since the beginning of the Middle Ages, is a something place in Judaism. To give you one simple example, think of Yosef Karo and Darizal, two giants of Judaism, who publish in it, or teach and publish in Israel. So the Shulchan Aruch, for example, now Yosef Karo born in Spain, he lived in Bulgaria and all, but he eventually made Aliyah. And the point is, he spent many years in Sfat. And the Arizal also, in somewhat different circumstances, and the other Kabbalists, meaning books start to come out, Sfarim, that are classic and basic, start to emerge out of Eretz Yisrael, including many of the customs that we practice nowadays. Think of Kabbalah Shabbos, which once upon a time never existed. You know, L'chadodi, L'chunaran, and all, it's not part of the real davening, but it's become universal Israeli custom to spread throughout the diaspora. So start to think of Israel starting to turn into something in the 1500s, but it's still very small. The Ashkenazic Jews moved there, very tiny numbers. They'd have the advantage of being locals. They're dependent usually on money from overseas. Some come and bring investments like the Shlach. If your investments go good, it's good. If they don't go good, it's not so good. There come famines and all kind of problems of economic life. The Turks are pretty money hungry, take a lot of extra taxes and things like this from the Jews. It's not easy. In the 1650s, middle of the 1600s, the Ashkenazi community is on the verge of starvation. The Sephardim don't know what to share with them, they're going to die. And they send them, Mashiach, to Oliver Cromwell's England. It's very interesting. And he gets money from Jerry Falwell. I kid you not. To go to, this is a period of Oliver Cromwell, when you had a lot of these extreme Protestant fundamentalist groups, the forerunners of what we later today call the American evangelists, the Falwell types. And they actually send money to the Ashkenazi community, which allows them to live. It was a famous Shaila, which doesn't exist today, in the Halachas Ketanas from Yaakov Chagiz, who's the big Sephardi rabbi. He's trying to revive and advance Sephardic Jewish culture in Jerusalem. in the 1650s, 1670s, are you allowed to take money? Are Jews allowed to take presents and money from Goyim? Right? And he said, but they do. Now, that's interesting because it never happened. What I just described never happened before. As Dr. Scheibitz, who was before me, told you in the Middle Ages that a Christian should do anything at all to help Jews is not enough for discussion. Right? I mean, you know, the Catholic medieval anti-Jewish feeling is, hot. And here it starts to differentiate. But now I want to get to my story. The late 1600s is Peter Shabtai Tzvi in the post-Sabbatian period. Shabtai Tzvi is mainly associated with being false messiah, but there's a lot more to it than that. And he certainly touched a button. We know that. Everybody fell for it. He certainly touched a button. And, I mean, rabbis, laymen, everybody. And not everybody saw it the same way, but one thing he did do is, he says, you know, we want Mashiach now. Maybe Mashiach's coming today, tomorrow, and the next day. A lot of people started to think this way. And already in the time of Shabtai Tzvi, and certainly afterwards, one of the ways they want to interpret it is, first of all, to do a lot of sigufim, which is self-tortures, because if the Messiah is coming tomorrow, I don't want to be a judgment day with all these sins on my consciousness, so maybe I can fast and hit myself and do things of this nature that the Sefer Chassidim, by the way, is very into, that we're speaking about before, so that I can purge myself. This was once upon a time a very widespread Jewish feeling, although today it's the antithesis, because we're all American and we're part of the modern world, and to us, in American and Western culture, the one great sin is don't touch the body. Do what you want to me, but don't touch my body. In the old days, they didn't look at it that way. And Aliyah to Israel. The Mashiach is coming, or may coming, maybe we're pre-Messianic era. One of the things that you want to do is be in the right place. Right? Because otherwise, maybe with the wars coming, we won't be able to get to Israel. And there's all these preachers that circulate throughout Eastern Europe that talk like this, and one of them is Yehuda Chassid, not Rabbi Yehuda Chassid of the 1200s, but a guy named Yehuda Chassid. Chassid just means he was real frum, and when I say real frum, doesn't mean he was a great scholar, Talmudist, and all that. They practice, as I say, many of these self-tortures and abstentions and ceremonies of self-abnegation and flagellation. That's what they used to call a Chassid once upon a time. The Baal Shem Tov changed all that, but I'm talking about before that. And this guy is a very good preacher, and by the time it's over, it's too a long story, by the time it's over, he gets 1,000 people to follow him to Israel, which is unheard of. This is the first mass aliyah, even though it's not that large, but the first mass aliyah since Ezra, that I know about anyway. Okay, everybody who ever moved to Israel moved a family or two. That's it. You go, you don't go. You understand? It's an individual thing. That someone should go with a whole group, and a large group means he's thinking in different terms, and he persuaded people to do it, and it's 1700, and there's wars raging in Europe, or it's right in between two wars that are about to rage in Europe, and he is able to get promises and money from court Jews, you know, the rich Jews of that time, the Wertheimers and the Oppenheimers. These were the guys who organized and ran the armies for the Holy Roman Emperor Leopold, and he gets passports for them to go through Europe, even though it's a very anti-Semitic time. 1,000 people make it to Israel, led by this guy. And he's got plans. We'll never know, because he died shortly after he got there, but he's obviously was an unusual guy. He might be, like you might say, the first proto-Zionist, in the sense that he wants to bring 1,000 people to Yerushalayim, buy a whole big neighborhood, not just a house or two, build there a synagogue, mikveh, stores, a little factory, some workplaces. In other words, like they say today, provide for economic basis, people make a living, and make a whole shchunah. And 1,000 people is going to double the Jewish population of Jerusalem. So it's not going to be a few new people, as was always the case. Somebody dies, somebody moves in, someone else dies, a few people move in, as it used to be. They die from a plague, some new people show up from elsewhere. This guy's coming with a big group, and they get there, and they get off the boat, and they walk to Jerusalem, which is not that far, and they buy the area, in what we call today the Old City, the Jewish Quarter, and they move in, and then he dies. Number one, which is the worst possible thing that happened at that moment. And second of all, the money didn't come in. The guys had promised from Europe, it didn't come in. To this day, people debate why, but that's what happened. And so you have a whole group of 1,000 people helpless. 1,000 people. And how do you eat? And so the short answer is you got to borrow. Well, that's bad news, right? Because you borrow, you can't pay it back. And so you got to borrow from this one, then you can borrow from this to pay this one back. And then you end up, as they say, borrowing from Peter to pay Paul. Moreover, who are you going to borrow from? the local moneylenders aren't stupid. Here's a desperate group. So I can basically charge you 100% interest compounded semi-daily or whatever, you know, whatever you want to do. Huge interest, had no choice. And you know where it's going to go. And years went by as they tried to work this out, but the debt got bigger and bigger until finally in 1718, the Arabs went crazy. I'm talking about the Christians, the Armenians. They were the main money lenders, but the Muslims also, they charged and attacked the Jewish quarter. They killed most of the people. They destroy all the houses and everything that was created. The synagogue, by the way, then becomes the Churba of Yehuda Chassid. That's why I call it the Churba Shul, right? Because it was destroyed by this mob. And the Ashkenazim, whoever survived, had to run away or pretend or become a Muslim or something like that. Because they couldn't pay the debt and nobody's going to protect them. Now, no, it got out of hand. The other Jews in Jerusalem and in Israel, Sephardim, they said, I guess, we're a different religion. As you know, there's Ashkenaz and Sephardim. We have nothing to do with them. And we're not certainly responsible for their debts and all the rest of it. With great difficulty, we were able to get the Turks to accept that. Wasn't easy at all. And so this was the situation. So by the time you get to 1719, 1720, there's no Ashkenaz Jews in Israel. Because not only this spread from Jerusalem to the other four or five cities where Jews live, because that's the only place they live in those days, is Jerusalem, is Hebron, is Gaza, is Tiberia, you know, up and down, and Akko. That's it. You know, and Sfas, of course. So, you know, the Jews didn't live anywhere else. And so the debt collectors knew where to go. And so no Ashkenaz Jews in Israel. Get over it. Now, yes?
How come the Ashkenazim and Sfarim couldn't get along? Was this guy a historical thing for it lasted a long... I've heard about the Machlokes, and they look upon...
Hold on. Just hold on. Just hold on. Okay. I'm serious. I'm not being funny. Now, but at the time I'm talking about, it makes total sense that Sfarim don't want to have anything to do with Ashkenazic debts. Right? If you got huge debts, I don't want to know you. You know? Because I don't want anybody to come to me. Right? I mean, you know, I don't want anybody to come to me. Now, the problem goes as follows. As I said before, the big problem with Israel is the Israelis. So the Jews in the Sephardim proceeded in the next 5-10 years to run up their own debts. Not overnight, not the way I just described it, with this dramatic situation with the mass aliyah of the Ashkenaz Jews of the 1,000, but simply through lack of transparency, stealing from the money, who's got the books, you know, the Mishalachim, who's in charge, the whole chaos creates a situation in which the community is undertaking debts to help the, you know, to run the communal affairs. The money in sufficient numbers wasn't coming from the other Sfarim at that time. Like I say, who knows what was skimming what from the top? We all know in Jewish life, even today, if it's not transparent, watch out. And so that's what happened at that time. And by the time you get to the 1730s, they are facing a similar crisis. And the Arabs are starting to mumble and grumble, and the Armenians and the Greeks and the other Christians and the other money lenders are starting to make trouble, and it's a difficult situation. The Jews of Jerusalem send out kol kareis all over the place. They help us. It's a holy obligation, all the rest of it. But, you know, it goes, if you give a nickel or a dime, so, you know, here's another nickel or dime. But if you want substantial contributions, you're talking about people with money, businessmen, bankers, and that sort of thing. They want to know where the money's going. Right? I don't know how you have in Chicago. Baltimore have the business with the Rabbi Heinemann's a ticket. Do you have that here? Like a slip, something like that? You know, so you want to verify the Mishulga. But whatever you want to say, my point's like this. If you're giving the guy 50 cents, what are you looking for? Yeah, you know. If you're giving a substantial donation, you want to say what you're giving it for. So that's at that time the same thing. And so great cynicism has arisen within the Sephardic world, the diaspora, what's going on in Israel. The Jews in Israel don't want to show any accountability. I'm talking about the ones in Yerushalayim particularly. It's a heads butting against heads. But by the time you get to 1740 or so, situation so desperate, Jews in Yerushalayim are looking, they're really in bad shape, and you know, the wolf is at the door, as they say, that they are compelled, much against their will, to, you know, adopt drastic measures. But what drastic measures can they adopt? Hold that thought. At that particular time, in Istanbul, in the capital of the Turkish Empire, and remember, we all know Israel is part of the Turkish Empire, the Ottoman Turkish Empire. That time, so everything I just told you was well known. A group of rich Jews in Turkey. These are Sephardim that are the wealthy ones. A lot of poor ones in Turkey, but these are the wealthy ones. These guys are bankers, money lenders, most particularly they're in connection with the government, because in the Turkish Ottoman Empire, every high official has a Jew. You understand? The head of the janissaries, the treasury. There's a Turkish Empire, very organized, don't get me wrong. Highly organized, very well run usually. But nevertheless, there's a lot of bribery, a lot of this, that, and the other, and people want somebody to run their investments. The old story. And so their Jews are well connected. And these were very patriotic Jews. They were Yiddish Yidden. It's interesting. You know, and people don't know about them. They were Jews. And they say, yeah, we don't like what's happened to Israel. And the problem, of course, is Israel can't be left at Israelis. It's the politics of financial responsibility. They're letting it run to the ground. And so they wrote to them and they said like this. They said, you know, we'll help you. There's a 5, 6, or 7, or 8. The Rosanis family, the Zana family, you know. And they said, yes, we're willing to miss the Quran. We'll get involved. But only if we get involved, only you got to give us financial control. You understand? We don't need the money. We have enough money around. We're willing to do this for Jewish patriotism, let's put it that way. But we can't have a business where we pour the money in here and we don't know where it goes. And so basically, if you agree, we'll send a control commission, 3 or 4 people, and you've got to put them totally in charge of the money. The Jews of Jerusalem did not want to do this in any way, and they fought bitterly, but at the end they had no choice. Because they say death was at the door. So in 1740 they came to Istanbul, Rafal Kimchi, some other big people from Jerusalem, and Bal Karcha Shalobu Tevasam, what they signed everything away, and they sent a commission from Istanbul, and they set themselves up at what they call Vada Pekidim, had a different name in Turkish, but you know, the committee of officials, and they said like this, these guys report to us. There's harsh conditions now. Our control commission is in charge of every penny that comes in and every penny that goes out. Nothing gets, but we want the books, not the books you show under somebody else. We want the real books. We got to see what the situation looks like. You understand? And you cannot spend any money except through our controller. And you cannot take in any money except through our guy. No more mishalachim. The only mishalach can go out of somebody we license. There was a lot of bad feeling, but they had, like I said, they had no choice. So they did do it. And from then on, for the next 5 decades, Jerusalem and Palestine in general was under financial control of what this Vada Pekidim. Okay? And indeed, they put out a kol kore throughout the Sephardic diaspora. So I guess no mishalochim, only the ones we say. Anybody else comes is a phony. And eventually, as I say before, despite the unwillingness, the system did take place, whereupon, once they were in charge, they said, yes, okay, they're going to be like businessmen. How much is the debt of the Sephardim? They're not talking about the Ashkenazim. They're not Ashkenazim. How much is the debt of the Sephardim? This and this and this. They want to collect it all into one single debt, one single right amount, negotiate a collective agreement with all the debtors, get it approved by the Ottoman Emperor, by the Sultan, and all the officials in Istanbul. And that's what they did. And they settled for something like 70 cents on the dollar, something that, along those lines. And they said to the creditors, listen, you're not dealing with the Israelis, you're dealing with us. If we sign, the money's coming in. And it did. And we'll pay this and this much every month, according to this and this schedule. And the creditors, like, something better than nothing. So they agreed. Especially their interest was very high, so they're getting more than their amount. And they agreed. They had this ratified by the imperial government, and they even had used their connections at the Ottoman court to get the administration in Jerusalem fired and put in their guys. Notice the Turks, you see? The guy, the Beir al-Abay and the Pasha and all the rest of them, these are people appointed from Istanbul that will come committed to implement this agreement. And they did do it. Right? They did do this. One of the key elements that they demanded was a limit on Aliyah. We can't have an irresponsible situation where everybody who wants to come, you know, they have a penny, it's almana, it's a this, then the other comes to just be a charge on the public money. We cannot afford this. We're not against people moving to Israel. We're trying to put this on a sound basis. That's the point, right? But for immediate purposes, you can't have that anybody wants to make Aliyah come to Aliyah only if we agree. So we have to license anyone who wants to move to Israel. Right? And we're only going to allow people in if somebody can make a job, contribute, pay taxes, in that business. So we're going to run Israel on a business basis and take it or leave it. It's at the end of the choice. This is what happened. Now, I'll say it again. We're not trying to reduce the population of the Jewish population. We're actually trying to increase it, but you can only do it if you lead on a sound basis. So in the short term, it's a decrease, and long term, it's an increase. You follow? So this is a very interesting episode in Jewish history. The problem is, what do you do about the Ashkenaz? And by that I mean that they have big debts. This group has big debts to deal with. They had large resources, but they had very big debts. Plus, in addition to paying the debts, now they got to run the administration of the Kehilot in the cities I just told you, particularly in Jerusalem, in Israel. Those are going to take on new financial obligations to run the place from now on. After all, whoever is there, that they're not kicking anybody out of Israel. They're just not letting anybody new in. So there are widows and orphans, there are institutions, there are schools and other things like this. And moreover, the Turkish taxes on Jews were crazy. I'm not talking about the debt. I'm talking about just the day-to-day taxes that were imposed on Jews were sky high. And who's going to handle all that? You follow? Who's going to handle all that? So they needed outside sources from Klal Yisrael, as you say. First they put out a cold correct to all the Sephardic world. Everybody should pay like a nickel or a dime, I forget, a small amount. And they did do it. From then on, there's like a coupon in every Sephardic community. And you give this in, organized by officials appointed by the community, centralized, and it's honest, and the money came to Istanbul, and from Istanbul it's dispersed in the proper way in Jerusalem and the other places in Israel. But what about Ashkenaz? That's a giant, big group of people. There's a lot of money out there. Once upon a time, long ago, when the Ashkenazim lived in Israel, not at the moment I'm talking about, there was a big system that the Ashkenaz had worked out over centuries of how to send the money to Israel. In Western Europe, they used to send it to Frankfurt and then to Amsterdam eventually. From Amsterdam, it would be done by bankers all the way through the Mediterranean to Palestine. In Italy, they had their system over there. In Poland, a very interesting, Poland at that time was on borders of the Turkish Empire. The Turks, perhaps you don't know, at their peak, owned one-third of Europe. You know, the Suleiman the Magnificent, these guys, they conquered a gigantic piece of Europe. The Budapest was a Turkish town. Remember? You know, they conquered that. And they were up to close to Vienna. And so Poland was on the border. So the Jews in Poland, which were the largest Jewish community in the world by far, there were far more Jews in Poland than in the rest of the Jewish people put together. You hear what I said? Today, I'm talking about the Kingdom of Poland, which is not what you have today. It's Eastern Europe. The Kingdom of Poland was Poland, Ukraine, Belarus, Lithuania, Latvia, a huge area. It's what you and I call Eastern European Jews, Russia, and it's all Polish Jews originally. This time, still a Kingdom of Poland. Very large area. A lot of poor Jews, a lot of rich Jews. So a lot of money used to come from Eretz Yisrael, because this is a Jewish thing. It's part of the traditional Judaism, that you give money to Israel. So a lot of money got put together. They had a system that would be switched on the Polish-Turkish border with these Jewish Sephardic bankers, and it was a way of transferring the money to Israel to the Ashkenazim. But there aren't any Ashkenazim, so the money's not coming in. And they want to get Ashkenazic Jews to participate in the scheme that I've just described. Why don't you guys kick in some money, a lot of money? After all, it's for Israel. But the rub, of course, is, what do you mean? It's for Sephardim. You want me to give money for your thing. You don't give money for my thing. You hear the problem. At this point, something most unusual happens. Here's like a movie. It's 1744. And it's the Kingdom of Poland, largest Jewish community, and the largest individual community in Poland in the 1700s, Brod, 7,000 Jews. Vilna at the time, I'm talking about, where the Vilna going lived, 2,500 Jews. You think of Vilna like a big town, it's a small town, Jewish-wise. Krakow, 2,500 Jews. Brody, 7,000 Jews. Very wealthy. A lot of rich Jews built up businesses there. That's how it got wealthy. How did it get wealthy? The Polish nobleman who ran the place wanted these Jews to do well because they get the business and the taxes. Matter of fact, in that very year, 1744, the town of Brody burned down, like Chicago did with Miss O'Leary. The whole town made out of wood, and somebody knocked over something. Next thing, the whole place went down. And all these big Jewish guys were wiped out because all their warehouses were destroyed. But the owner of the town and the province, Prince Poniatowski, summoned the 10 leading Jewish merchants who were wiped out to his palace. He opened the safe and gave each guy, like what we say today, is $100,000 as a gift. And he didn't like Jews, but he's not dumb. If you give somebody who's unqualified $100,000, they'll blow it in a week in Vegas. Weekend. Right? They don't have to do with the money. But if you give a businessman, a real businessman, $100,000, what's he going to do with it? He's going to blow it in Vegas. He's going to immediately start to... Exactly. He's going to start his business up again. And these guys went to Leipzig, which is a big international fair. They had cash in hand, and they were able to buy a tremendous amount and get a bargain, and they brought the stuff back. And within 2 years, the city was rebuilt double the size, and the warehouses and the wharves were three times the size, and Brody was trading with Connecticut and with China. It's unbelievable. Is it with Persia? So he got his money back big time. He was an intelligent steward of his own economic interests, as all the Polish noblemen were. Right? They were not dummies at all. So in this town, among other things, was the number one kolel in the world, the Klois of Brody, they called it. There was a number, certainly the leading Ashkenazi probably in the world. Because there was a rich guy, Babad family, and they, Rabinowitz, and they bankrolled, mostly for their relatives and others, a situation which you had what we today call a kolel. A Klois was what they used to have in early modern Ashkenaz, and a Klois means that somebody, usually a rich lady, by the way, puts together an amount of money, something like the term you see in kolel, put an amount of money for 10 scholars, 12, whatever, something like that, for 5 years, 6 years, and they got to learn. I mean, learn. So you only come home on Shabbos. The rest of the week, you have to, you know, they want value for money. You sleep in the base medrash and all that sort of thing. And after 5-6 years, obviously you're talking about an elitist group, and they will go out to be the rabbis and dayanim of the next generation. And very, very famous, very successful in this regard. The Poles and the Austrians used to call it the Jewish Sorbonne. You see? It is the university. And here you had people foremost rank in Talmudism and foremost rank in Kabbalistic knowledge among the Ashkenaz. Now, a lot to talk about, but I won't. At the time I'm speaking about, Notabi Yehuda, Cheskel Landau, still a young man from an elite family, married a girl from an elite family, very religious, obviously, very great genius, and he's in the kolel there, in the Klois of Brody. And with others, another one there is his best friend, his chavrusa, Avram Gershom Kutover, who you may perhaps have heard, possibly, because his sister married the Baal Shem Tov, and the famous tale of the Baal Shem Tov. This is the whole point of the story, that the Baal Shem Tov, who's a nobody in that thing, married the sister of a super elite scholar. You understand? That's all, the Shivchei Abesh, that's a big deal. And Rav Meir, and other names. At this point in 1744, a scandal broke out, right? A huge scandal broke out of a sexual nature that blew the whole town, sky high, and had a lot of fallout because the lady involved was the daughter of the rich guy who owns the whole kolel in the town. And what do you do about the fact that on the one hand, she clearly was, everybody's talking about her because everybody was involved with her in the town. It was a shock. And what's the fallout? What do you do? If you have in there, I don't want to read the whole thing, but I'll read you a little bit of it on your page. The Notabi Yehuda published this in 1776 without mentioning any names, and as if it's a question he was asked from a foreign country. He said, "Shluchayli mechachamim Ashkenaz kitzayir it's lois from a foreign country." He said, "Ma'aseir shakodem Rosh Hashanah derech kol eretz l'torer kolchol yishubitz mechatov," that it was the style in the time of our ancestors, my friends, that in the month of Elul. People not only did teshuva, but they wanted to do confession. Today we associate with the Catholic Church, but the Jews had a lot of this stuff also, and they would have something called birurei averos, which means there would be people in the community who were designated people with discretion. You know, they have a big mouth, and somebody feels like this: before Rosh Hashanah, I want to go over and talk to this rabbi, whoever, and say, "Listen, I've done this, and this, and this, and else, and you know, what should I do before Rosh Hashanah, before Yom HaDin?" Okay, this is what once upon a time. Problem is that they had this guy, Birurei Averot, and one guy came over and says, "I have to confess, I was involved in an adulterous relationship with this married woman." And then like a day or two later, another guy said, "I have to confess, I was involved in an adulterous relationship with this married woman." Same woman. And the next day, another guy. So it was like crazy. So, it's the way that people repent from their sins. Ubal Kamanashim Lifnei Bezdin Biruri Averus Lehit Vador Rabbanam to do Vidui Lekabel Teshuva and to accept a penance, not a repentance, but a penance. Kasha Yoramar Besigufim Tanesim Shubas Amishkal Abunasov. Everybody should, as they say, punish themselves or do penitential acts. Ubalakab Bifnei Atzmo, and different guys came on different days. But vision is Vadala Bezdin, and the Bezdin then realized, Maisa Zanunim Shalisha Plonis. There's an act of adultery by a certain woman. He doesn't name the name. He actually was related to all these people, you know, because they're this elite family, so the whole kolo is all related to each other. And Asher Kvarzek comes, Yosalea, Kolod Lopusik, Shazin saw that there's a rumor that won't die out that she's involved in Zanus. Finis Gabra calls Vahim, and it's come up in times in the past. Achshim Mishpachada, Isha Vavi Abal, Hain Takifim Van Shizroa. But her father and relatives are very powerful people. Notice they're tight with the Polish landlord, and they can kill you. I'll put it bluntly. They can get you in trouble. And therefore, anybody who talks about it, they suppress it, or beat them up. And in the past, whenever these rumors popped up from time to time, they suppressed it through main force. Okay? But obviously, this woman had problems. And so, now you see a whole bunch of people involved here. And what they basically like this. They called the father, who's the power broker over here, at night when nobody saw it. Listen, your daughter's involved in a bad situation. Alpidin, she cannot stay married to her husband. What can you do? We don't want to make this public. We don't want to make a whole business out of it. Just, you take care of it, you know, say irreconcilable differences, things like that, and just get a divorce. Nobody has to know anything. All we want is that the halacha be followed. We're not interested in making anything public or a blow up over here. So they try to be diplomatic. And the guy says, I want to hear the witnesses myself at night when nobody's listening. And under a chair, meaning under the excommunication order, that if they tell me a lie, they'll be excommunicated. The chain also, the yonim take a balayla, I'll be diwash zigidu. And the witnesses came forth under these situations all privately, and they told what they told. But take of gizim lahagilo mimeim edim. He said, who are the witnesses? Vaitzabu yazimakas azarios. And the Bezdin wouldn't say who the witnesses are at first, so he had the Bezdin beat up. Okay, he brought a Polish goon squad. This is life in the early modern period in Ashkenazi Jewry in Eastern Europe, in some cases. And this is the best of the communities. Brody was the most chashuv over here. And this is straight in the Yehuda. For low Russia Lagalolos, the Bezdin didn't want to tell. Here he's torturing the rabbis, and they won't tell. And they said, they're beating up. I said, what do you need this for? Malacholios Zona Beveischa. Right, you know, what just make it go away. You know, what are you going on? Are you crazy? And he's a frum guy, as they say. And after this whole set, what he did was, being the guy who was the mafia boss, so to speak, of the Jewish community, he convened an official meeting of the Kehillah, right, which he dominates, and the Dayanim, and basically using his power, he forced them to come, and make a long story short, they testified, he beat them up, he beat up anybody that spoke about it to death's door, and he goes through the, in the next lines, the actual testimony they gave, which is pretty gross, or pretty graphic, let's put it this way, and make a long story short, I don't read the whole thing, it's too long for our time now, but you can take a look, this is Orach Chaim, I'll say it again, it's Ebn Ezra 72, it's very famous. Ebn Ezra in the Noda Behuda, which is not an easy text, but it's not so hard either. And it's in the response of the Shalos and Shupas. It's a famous case, it's the kind of thing you run across sometimes. And that's life, a part of life. And the end of the story is that the guy, the father, whose name was Rabinowitz, as I say before, Ba'abat, Ben Abezin, Rabinowitz. So he got the Polish authorities on his side, and he put out a cherem. Anybody who speaks about this or accuses my daughter of anything will be either killed or beaten up or pay a lot of money or something like that. And everybody's terrorized. Okay? But it's a very famous story that Nodav Yudah Cheskel, he can't stand it, even though he's a cousin. And the girl's father went to a very famous rabbi, Chaim Cohen Rappaport. And he's basically solicited from him a responsum justifying that the daughter does not have to get divorced on technical grounds. And there are, by the way, there are halachic grounds. It's good for a shir, but not for a year. There are halachic grounds having to do with drisha v'chakira and what we would call today due process issues. But there's due process issues in Jewish law as there are in American law. And you can get a case overthrown over here if there are due process violations. Agree? The Noda B'Yud himself couldn't stand this. And he writes a very long teshuva on the other side in which he says, as if he's imagining this theoretically, he says, there are six possible heterim that one could think of to justify this couple staying married. And now I'm going to spend 30 pages demolishing each one of these heterim. Stiras heter rishon, stiras heter sheni, and so on and so forth. And great lumdas and pilpul up and down, back and forth. And to be perfectly honest, you could argue this way, you could argue this, but that's what he did. Now the famous story is, as a result, he was seized by the authorities, but since he was rich, he had to pay a large fine. There was another guy, Mary Nesivim, whatever called him, he was beaten up. And the third one, Avram Gershon Kotover, they threatened to beat the heck out of him, and he wouldn't survive because he was weak. And so he fled. That's the story. He fled with Brody. So you find a lot of interesting stories in the Shalos and Tshuvos. And once he fled, where are you going to go to? So he was very religious. Very, very, very religious. So he said, if I got to leave, I'm going to go to Israel. Right? This is, he said, aside from God, I'm going to go to Israel. Every from Jew, once upon a time, at least theoretically, was to go to Israel. The Noda B'Yehuda himself, when he was young, he writes in the Hesped he delivers for his wife many years later. She said, I married, she was a real hero. When I was young, we thought of going to Israel, and she was ready to go. And in those days, that was enough to tell you. It's extremely, extremely hard. Tell me what it's like to raise a family and have childbirth, things like this, in the terrible conditions of Palestine in the 18th century. Right? So she was ready to do it. Now, this Avram Gershon Kotover, therefore, travels from Brody, he runs from Brody through the Balkans towards Israel and stop in Istanbul, right in 1745. What's happening at that time? The committee of the bankers of the Sephardim are looking around and say, they're trying to come up with plans. How can we bring the Ashkenaz in on this? We have no connections with them, and like you said, they're not going to give any money to a foreign cause. But here comes Avram Gershon Kotover, who's a renowned scholar and all the rest of it, and he comes there, and then he said, like this, let's introduce ourselves to each other. We're so-and-so, you're such-and-such, you went to Galia. We're happy to support you, you know. Why don't you give the word back to your brother-in-law, your friend, Cheskel Landau, people like that, who are influential Jews in Poland. Come with the program. We're trying to build up Israel for everybody. Right now it's Sephardim, but you know, but Yerushka, little by little, we'll bring it in. The key point is to have all the Jewish people together, if possible, under one financial and business-like arrangement to build up on a sound basis the future of Israel. So think Klal Yisrael over here instead of just Ashkenaz and Sephardim. And he does. And he is very impressed with who he runs into, and he writes back to the Noda B'Yehuda, we have this in the other Shalos and Tshuvos after this, and he says, you know, I ran into these guys, and this guy died, but this guy's in charge now, Zonana family, and they're very patriotic Jews, they're good people, all the rest of it, and they're going to help me make Aliyah in Israel, which they do. He moves in 1745, first modern Ashkenazic Jew, meaning after the old guys were kicked out. This is the first time under a new plan. I don't know why they didn't hit him for the money. Maybe they were bribed, the Turks or something, to look the other way. He lives in Jerusalem and in Hebron. Now, it's a cultural difference. He writes to the Baal Shem Tov, he says, I have no way to talk to. Because he talk Yiddish, they talk Ladino. The Ashkenaz, especially those, they were very Ashkenazic. The Sephardi, very Sephardi, but they give him a lot of cover. And he settled there and lived there for the rest of his life. And he's basically the foundation of the modern Ashkenazic Aliyah. Okay? Avraham Gershon Kotover, because he was a big person. And his friend moved on to be the chief rabbi of Prague, the Noda B'Yehuda, as you probably heard. Became an extremely influential person in the Ashkenazic world. And he puts his full weight of his authority behind the idea that the Ashkenaz should collect the money and send it to this group in Israel, in Istanbul, because they're the only ones who are responsible in a business way of making sure the money will be spent the right way. And this begins an era of 40 years, a little more, in which you have, for the only time in Jewish history, the Ashkenaz and Sephardim on the same page, okay, on the same page, and if the money's going through the centrally directed situation. And the results were that in the short run, of course, they cut down on the aliyah because they didn't want people who will not be able to contribute or won't be able to be the right type to Israel. But once they got the debt under control, and eventually they paid it off after 60 years, made monthly payments, and once they got the taxes, the other issue under control, then they start little by little bringing in people. Little by little bringing in people. And so Avraham Gershkovich goes to the first Ashkenaz. 20 years later, less than 20 years later, the first Hasidic immigrants move to Tiberias. Not to Jerusalem, because you come to Jerusalem, it's a little too much. That's where the riots were, and that's where the money is still owed. Okay? So the Ashkenazic debt nobody ever touched. That was like the white elephant on the table. But if you lay low, and especially you daven Nusach Sephardi, as we say, and you pretend to be a little bit Sephardi, you can kind of stay under the radar a little bit. And then, no, I'm saying this is the foundations, or the Yeshuva Yashan, as we call it today. Right? First come the Hasidic, a few years later come the students of the Vilna Gaon. Same way, you go to Tveria, Akko, Lelo. If somebody asks you, you say you're Sephardi, you know, things like that. And this group took the population of Jerusalem when they were in charge, it was a 500, the Jews were down to 500, and built up to 3,000. Okay? Little by little. So they had like monthly meetings, like business, and they built 3,000. That means in the 1780s, there were 3,000, 2,800 Jews in Jerusalem. That was the largest single ethnic group in the city at that time. No, it was total, there were more Goyim. But there were less than 2,800 Muslims. Think about that. Jerusalem isn't what you know, it's only the old city. There were less than 2,800 Armenians. There were less than 2,800 Greek Orthodox. That's how they used to divide this stuff up, right? There are less than 2,800 whatever, right? But there are more than 2,800 Jews. So from that time on, the Jews were the largest single group in Yerushalayim and have remained so till today. This is what they call the foundation of the modern state of Israel. Because since Jerusalem had the largest and maintained and continued to be the largest single group in Jerusalem, they became at least one place in Yerushalayim, in Eretz Yisrael, in which there's a large Jewish community. Maybe they're Zionists, maybe not Zionists, you know, that was all big fights. But because it was big fights. But we forget, at times when you had people starting with the kibbutz, where there's 100 people here, 20 people there, but Yerushalayim is tens of thousands, already at that time, 100 years ago, 150 years ago, tens of thousands. And the origins were here. In the 1770s, the system starts to crack. Because once, little by little, Ashkenazi Jews started to go there, it's against their nature to not send Mishalachim. What else is there, right? It's against their nature. The whole plan depended, if you follow what I've been saying, the whole plan depended on centralization and licensing of Mishalachim. Nobody can come and just say, I'm from Israel. It had to be a system where somebody had a documentation and correspondence had to be maintained with other committees throughout Europe. And here comes, but how are you going to stop it? Unless you really stop it. And so the son of Avraham Gershon Kotzebue himself is one of these guys. He said, I'm not getting enough money. He goes to Germany and to Central Europe in 1770s. And, you know, when people tell you, I mean, you can understand, when people tell you, I thought that there's one big Sephardi community. Yeah, the Sephardi would keep all the money for himself. They give him enough to Ashkenaz. It's a big discrimination. Of course he's lying. He wants to be, see, give me the money. You understand? And how do you go, and it's the easiest thing in the world, to heat up the kind of rivalry that you were asking the question. So Ashkenaz, 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 they're sticking it to us, they're lying, they're cheating, and so you should really know what's going on over there. I mean, it's the old Israeli politics that we have till today. And what's really interesting is that the committee in Istanbul writes to the Nerav Yehuda, who was the leading Ashkenazic rabbi in 1770, and says, help us out of here. You know that this is not the case. And there's a letter he writes, they brought me from Baltimore. This is from a book. If you're at all interested in what I'm talking about, there's a fat book by Avraham Yari. I mean, that fat, called Shluchei Deretz Yisrael, History of all the Mishalachim from Israel for 600 or 700 years. And he goes into incredible detail, and you see the best and the worst of the Jewish character. Right? The best and the worst. And in 1777, I think, 1771, they solicit for him a letter, and the Nerav Yehuda publishes a letter throughout all Ashkenaz, and he had a lot of prestige behind it. And what he says is as follows, and this will probably be the last item I'm going to speak about. He writes the letter and he says, Halo av echa lekulanu. He said, my fellow European Jews, he said, we have echel kulon, we have one father. Why do we have to emphasize the difference? Why don't you emphasize what's common? And I happen to know clearly and personally, they spend the money fairly. When the Ashkenaz also, when anybody moves to Israel. I know my good friend, Avram Gershon Kutover, as long as he was in Israel, he got a nice check every month, as we would say. You know, they treat him very, very fairly. They didn't skimp on him. It's known that all the money goes to the Sephardim, but what do you think the committee does with it? They have to spend it on the huge taxes. Every Ashkenaz Jew, as well as every Sephard Jew, is a huge liability because the Turks charge a very heavy head tax, and then a sales tax, and a this tax, and a that tax. Plus, we have the national debt that we're trying to retire. He's talking about the Sephardic debt, of course. The national debt that we're trying to retire over here. So they're not using the money, you know what I mean, to discriminate one group against another, and somebody should live high in the hog and the other one is starving. Being Cain, Hari, double Tovus HaKlal Kulo, Sephardim Ashkenaz, the money is for the Tovus HaKlal, Kilu Leze Lohayu Kim Lushum Ish Yisrael Be'eretz HaKadosha. If this system, if you don't keep this system going on, not a single Jew will be able to survive in Israel for financial and for political reasons. My dear brothers, keep your monies that you raise locally, the kupa, in your communities, and when a designated guy from the official group comes, in other words, what he's saying is, don't give it to Mishalachim. Don't give them a shalachim, because that'll kill the system, and it'll hurt Eretz Yisrael, in a Klal Yisrael kind of way. As I said before, by the time Noda Yehuda died in 1793, he was already somewhat out of commission. A little earlier than that, authority of people like him waned, and as a result, by the time you get to 1800 thereabouts, system went into desuetude, and the Ashkenaz doing the Ashkenaz and the Sephard doing the Sephard. And that was not a good thing, but that's what happened. And as a result, the organized Aliyah of the type that I described, which was done under the organizational principles that I just laid out, fell in and it became everybody for himself. Just to finish the story, what happened to the Ashkenazic debt? As I said before, the early Jews came there. You couldn't get rid of it. It was on the books. And it wouldn't go away. Montefiore, in the 1840s, when he went for the famous Damascus blood libel, I'm sure many you probably know what I'm talking about, he came to Istanbul, and Montefiore at that time was a friend of Queen Victoria, Lord Palmerston, and the Turks needed the British desperately to stave off Russia. That's called the Eastern Question. That's the big politics of the 19th century. And so they had to kiss up to people like Montefiore, and he said like this, you know, how much money are we talking about? Let's be realistic. Let's, as I said before, let's settle for 20 cents on the dollar. It's only, I mean, you're talking about 150-year-old debt, you know, 20 cents on the dollar. And the Turkish government didn't confirm it. Took a while. Everything takes a while over there. Took a while, and they got it confirmed. And then he paid off the money. And then the Jews, Ashkenaz Jews, were officially, formally, legally allowed to move to Israel unrestricted. And one of the things they then proceeded to do was rebuild the Churban Synagogue. Okay. Now here, Montefiore was chaptized by the brother-in-law Rothschild. He wanted to show off. Rothschild said, when it came to settling the debt, he wasn't to be seen. But he came, you know, for the unglorious part. But for the glorious part, he hired, if anybody's seen pictures of it, the Churban Shul, which was built in the 1800s, was magnificent and gigantic. And was the headquarters of the Ashkenaz. And when I say Ashkenaz, I mean non-Hasidic, the Hasidim got jealous, and they built a model synagogue on the same size. I think they called it Tiferes Yisrael. And for the Rishon Rebbe, Yisrael Rishon, a guy Nissen Beck. He was a chassid of the Brizner Rebbe, and he lived in Israel, and he was a very active type guy, and he had to go back and forth to the Ottoman court, but he made it happen, and he raised the money for a Hasidic. So it's a typical Jewish style. He had two Ashkenazi shul. Very big and magnificent, one for Nusach Ashkenaz, one like we say today, one for Nusach Ashkenaz, Nusach Sfarad, not Sfaradi, right? Nusach Ashkenaz, Nusach Sfarad is a very famous story that's associated with the Nissenbeck shul because they ran out of money, as happens in synagogues sometimes, and so they had no roof. They had no roof. And they wouldn't make, because in the 19th century, Moorish architecture, they wouldn't make a dome, which the Churva synagogue had. Churva synagogue had money coming out of its ear, but this one didn't have that, and they were stuck there. It rained, you know what I mean? It was a real mess. In 1869, they dedicated the Suez Canal. Ferdinand Lesseps built the Suez Canal, and all the crowned heads of Europe came for a big party. And all the crown heads of Europe, Napoleon III, the Emperor of Russia, and one of them was Franz Josef, the Emperor of Austria-Hungary, who was a very firm Catholic. And he visited Palestine, the holy sites. And he gave a lot of money for all the Catholic things because he was a Habsburg and a very loyal Catholic. And when he came there, they invited him to go to what we would call today the Old City, because there was Kolel, Austria-Hungary. You know, there were a lot of Austrian-Hungarian and Galiciana Jews who lived there. And of course, they gave him a big covet and so forth. And this is Beck standing there in front of the shul. He says, "This is the shul we're planning to build." And Franz Josef goes, "Where's the roof?" And it's a famous story. Nissen Beck. So I guess he says, "See, even all the buildings are doffing their caps to you, Your Majesty." Yeah, something like this. So he understood the mushul and he said, "I'll cover the money." And he paid for it. So that's how the shul got built. I can only conclude the last part of the grid. A very important historical event happened 2 years ago when the great-great-grandson of Nissen Beck married my daughter. We're done. Huh? Are there any questions? Great. Okay.
Thank you very much. Thank you everyone for coming and have a great day.
I just want to close with a personal hakaras hatov note to Rabbi Dr. Katz. How many times I spent Friday night at the Katz home in high school learning Medrash Rabbah and many other things with my great teacher, and I want to be makar tov for coming and sharing his great wisdom and humor and wit with us. Have a great day, everyone, and all the best.